the floor is yours as soon as you want to start. Welcome.
This is Aura 20, Voyages into Listening and Writing, with Daniela Cascella and myself, Salome Vögelin. Today we are doing a live performance at the Royal College of Music in London as part of the Science Museum and the Nottingham University HSC Network event, Exploring Silence and Music.
Is there anything on Earth which would have meaning and would even change the course of events, not only on Earth, but in other worlds? I asked my teacher. There is, my teacher answered me. Well, what is it? I asked. It's, began my teacher, and suddenly felt silent. I stood and waited intently for his answer, but he was silent, and I stood and was silent, and he was silent, and I stood silent. And he was silent, and I stood and was silent, and he was silent, and I stood silent, and he was silent. We're both standing and silent. Ho la la, we're both standing and silent. Ho le le, yes, yes, we're both standing and silent.
Their room smelled the way it hadn't smelled before. The curtains and the window had been opened. The air inside was cold, but still it smelled different. Not like death, but a clean, astringent odor, as though the room had been gone over, scrubbed and put right at some point. Outside somewhere a dog was barking, a slow, determined barking. Something the dog saw but didn't recognize. A mystery. Something that didn't fit into its regular world. Their luggage was still stacked where he'd put it when they'd come back last night. Nothing was very different in the room. The Arab pictures were the same. The fluorescent light had been turned on. An empty bottle of Bombay gin had been added. Several, possibly four in all, clear plastic freezer bags, empty. A glass from the bathroom, also empty. An ashtray with two cigarettes, stubbed out. But mostly neat. Had they scrubbed the room? He wondered. Who'd opened the window? He realized he felt slightly faint. Helen lay on her side, her right hand open under her cheek, her left hand lost beneath the covers. She was wearing at least her pale pink pyjama topped with dark pipping. Her glasses were on the table beside the plastic freezer bags and his note. She was very, very pale, her features fixed, her thick hair wasn't disarranged. Her bottom lip seemed to be tucked in under the top, her teeth undoubtedly resting on it. It was an attitude of sleep. In the hallway outside, he heard the elevator door open, then whispers. A woman's whispers and a man's. Suddenly, a young Indian woman came into the doorway. One of the maids, in a loose-fitting, beltless seersucker dress. A large girl. She leaned in, looked at the bed and gasped, then disappeared. In a moment, the elevator closed. On the night table were two white envelopes, one marked Management, Hotel Nouvelle Métropole, seulement. He sat in the green chair and opened it immediately. In it was a folded piece of white notepaper on which was written, "My fate is my responsibility. Mr. Matthew is not my husband." It was signed Helen Carmichael. Her passport was enclosed. The other envelope was marked Mr. Matthew. In it was a simple piece of folded notepaper on which he read these things. "My last thoughts. I'm hurrying. I don't want you to come back and find me alive. Death is my little secret. I would like to stay in France. Please try for that. I really just don't fit anymore among the living. I mean, it's really no more complicated than that. This stuff already seems to be working. I think a good life is supposed to be to die knowing nothing, or maybe it's to die knowing nobody. Anyway, I've almost succeeded at both of them. Only in paradise if death's banned from claiming the weak. This is saying I've been saving. I forgot where I heard it. Maybe TV. This stuff is working. We were never in love. Don't misunderstand that. It will make all this trouble much easier. A cancer cell is just one organism proliferated. I thought of it being like a novel representing all of life and we had that in common, but it's not. It's not a metaphor. Don't open the other envelope, please. Goodbye. Good luck. Affectionately, Helen."
It wasn't all work, of course. Two or three times a week, Max would haul up that enormous oil painting that had been presented to her by some Nevada Chamber of Commerce. And we'd see a movie, right in her living room. So much nicer than going out, she'd say. The plain fact was she was afraid of that world outside. Afraid it would remind her that time had passed. They were silent movies. And Max would run the projection machine, which was just as well. It kept him from giving us an accompaniment on that wheezing organ. She'd sit very close to me, and she smelled of tube roses, which is not my favorite perfume, not by a long shot. Sometimes, as we watched, she'd clutch my arm or my hand, forgetting she was my employer, just becoming a fan, excited about that actress up there on the screen. I guess I don't have to tell you who the star was. They were always her pictures. That's all she wanted to see.
Still wonderful, isn't it? And no dialogue. We didn't need dialogue. We had faces.
The silent inner voice is paradoxically an articulated figure. a second shadowy body that at times may come alive here and there to extend our own. We are prone to particular slippages according to the pulse and tremble of inner speech, that quiet murmur just behind the throat, and which may also suddenly appear out there to affect an influence, to loop through the soundings of voice all that lurks behind with what is waiting in front, that is, to break out and into audibility. This audibility may be heard at first in Sleep Talk. Paul Dickinson's thoroughly evocative audio work, Sleep Talk, Recordings Volume 1, captures the speech that leaks out in the middle of the night. Developed over the course of 1998 and 1999, Dickinson had himself monitored and recorded at a sleep center in Chicago. The subsequent recording captured him speaking aloud, resulting in highly suggestive fragments of talk, murmuring, exclaiming, a nocturnal diary that literally ghosts the diurnal body located within the sociable movements of the everyday. As one transcription reads, 1999, November 1. A vous a vous passez, pied à pied, head, hello, gone by a lil, piss what I did, getting oula from you.
In the meantime, I have found out who you are, says the doctor, when you meet him on the terrace in the early evening. You are a composer, and you won't deny that. Of course not, you reply. Why should you? And you qualify that by telling him that you compose next to nothing anymore, although years ago you had once worked your way up in the so-called concert business of this city, from which, however, on your initiative, you deliberately and intentionally ejected yourself, because that sort of business seems extremely ill-suited for the type of music you have in mind, music that you yourself are not even in a position to write, because the development of the human sense organs has undergone a terribly widespread anatomical stagnation. So how do you make your living, he asks, in the same tone of voice as if he had asked how you make your dying. My publisher, you reply, of course knows that I'm not composing anything more, and has therefore commissioned me to make the most detailed notes of all my analytical thoughts about both the future of music and the music of the future by describing how and why I no longer compose anything. He thinks that by writing down all my thoughts about a music that is, at least today, still not able to be composed, I will at some time start composing again of my own accord without noticing it myself, and someday I will suddenly be in position to compose that music that has not yet even touched the farthest reaches of the imagination, which is why until then he has commissioned me to write a definitive account of all my thoughts about the world of sound, and thus to write nothing more or less than my theoretical life's work, for whose closing, final completion, however, I intend to need all the time remaining to me until the end of my life.
But before the bang, silence. But is it a silence that can only ever be conceptual, an oral metaphor that relieves the thinker from the mental strain of thinking nothingness? Cosmic noise, by revealing the essentially conceptual and non-sonic essence of silence, introduces one of the more awkward relationships between categories of sound. We could think of this aspect of relations between sonic categories as almost an undoing or reversal. A silence becomes non-sound or unsound, calling into question what would normally be considered a main vector in the sonic axis of sound, silence, noise, and music. Silence is also therefore a term that conjures creation, production, in short, existence. The concept of the Big Bang introduces silence as an always already existent, from which existence arises via negation, enabling the universe to have always existed and to come into existence at the same time. Grasp the sweetness, the errors, in what you wrote to me, with this delicacy, concertedly, and I couldn't take it seriously. I mistrusted it, but I think I also loved it. Maybe I did not love it, but I loved you. I wrote back like this. Jake, I'm in Munich. I think I'll visit Dachau tomorrow. I barely spoke for the 7 hours we were in the car. The mountains are stupefying. That was my explanation. I miss you. I left you an envelope in the lobby. I have to go now. Love, Ariana.
All very fine, but the voice is failing. It's the first time, no, I've been through that. It has even stopped many a time. That's how it will end again. I'll go silent for want of air. Then the voice will come back and I'll begin again. My voice, the voice. I hardly hear it anymore. I'm going silent. Hearing this voice no more, that's what I call going silent. That is to say, I'll hear it still if I listen hard. I listen hard, listening hard. That's what I call going silent. I'll hear it still, broken, faint, unintelligible, if I listen hard. Hearing it still, without hearing what it says, that's what I call going silent. Then it will flare up, like a kindling fire, like a dying fire, and I'll emerge from silence, hearing too little to be able to speak. That's my silence. That is to say, I never stop speaking, but sometimes too low, too far away, too far within, to hear. No, I hear, to understand, not that I ever understand. It fades, it goes in behind the door. I'm going silent. There's going to be silence. I listen. It's worse than speaking. No, no worse, no better. Unless this time is the true silence, the one I'll never have to break anymore, when I won't have to listen anymore, when I can dribble in my corner, my head gone, my tongue dead, the one I have tried to earn, that I thought I could earn. I'm going to stop, that is to say, I'm going to look as if I had. It will be like everything else. As if anyone were looking at me, as if it were I. It will be the same silence, the same as ever, murmurous with muted lamentation, panting and exhaling of impossible sorrow like distant laughter and brief spells of hush, as of one buried before his time. Long or short, the same silence, Then I resurrect and begin again. That's what I'll have got for all my pains, unless this time is the real silence at last. Perhaps I've said the thing that had to be said, that gives me the right to be done with speech, done with listening, done with hearing, without my knowing it. I'm listening already, I'm going silent. The next time I won't go to such pains, no matter which, they're all alike, they won't tire me, I won't bother any more about me. I'll know that no matter what I say, the result is the same, that I'll never be silent, never at peace. Unless I try once more, just once more, one last time, to say what has to be said about me, I feel it's about me, perhaps that's the mistake I make. Perhaps that's my sin, so has to have nothing more to say, nothing more to hear, till I die. It's coming back, I'm glad. I'll try again, quick before it goes again. Try what? I don't know. To continue. Now there is no one left. That's a good continuation, no one left. It's embarrassing. If I had a memory, my telling that this is the sign of the end, is having no one left, no one to talk to, no one to talk to me. So what you have to say, it is I'm the one doing this to me, I'm the one talking to me about me.
Together, the aesthetic politics of silence and noise has been a useful way of framing or demarcating the field of sonic power. For example, in the history of musical aesthetics, silence, from John Cage onward, has been conjoined to the virtual in that it constitutes the shadow of audition, the non-conscious background, perceivable only through absence and with only a negative possibility of entering conscious attention. Silence here is sound in potential, unactualized. Similarly, the concept of noise from futurism onward came to mean the potential of any sound whatsoever to disrupt and move forward musical jurisdictions as policed by generic criteria, critical border patrols, or harmonic or melodic parameters of organized sound. Both of these aesthetic tendencies within the remit of a politics of amplitude are often placed in allegiance to an anti-capitalist politics. In these cases, in noise pollution policy, for example, strategic resonances are recognized in local tactical interventions in the force fields of sonic ecologies. Yet the silence-noise axis has several drawbacks. The politics of silence often assumes a conservative guise and promotes itself as quasi-spiritual and nostalgic for a return to a natural. As such, it is often orientalized and romanticizes tranquility unviolated by the machinations of technology, which have militarized the sonic and polluted the rural soundscape with noise, polluted art with sonification, polluted the city with industry, polluted thoughts with distraction, polluted attention with marketing deafens teenagers, and so on.
This is Timothy's camera. During the fatal attack, there was no time to remove the lens cap. Jewel Palavec allowed me to listen to the audio.
I hear rain and I hear Amy, get away, go away. Can you turn it off? Julie, you must never listen to this.
Brings to audiences this his most stunning film, The Silence. This compelling drama is an intimate, fascinating look into a world where people seek to communicate through the ruthless gratification of their sexual appetites. Starring in a brilliant portrayal of the delicate and complexing intimacies of lesbian love, Ingrid Tulin, and as her sister, a beautiful, arrogant creature of the flesh, living only for lust and licentious pleasure, Gunnell Lindblom. Two women traveling through a strange land, a strange existence, where they find loneliness and a desperate passion. Few films in the history of the cinema have created the stir and controversy this film has raised by giving a long, searing look into the mute hearts of those who indulge their carnal fancies. The Silence.
Mystical. On the slope of the embankment, angels swirl their woolen dresses through pastures of steel and emerald. Meadows of flame leap to the top of the knoll. On the left, the compass of the ridge has been trampled by all the homicides and all the battles and all the catastrophic sounds describe their curve. Behind the right-hand ridge is the line of Orient, of progress. And while the strip at the top of the picture is fashioned from the turning and leaping sound of the conches of the sea and of human nights, the flowery sweetness of stars and sky and the rest descends opposite the embankment, like a basket against our face, and creates the flowering and blue abyss down there.
When I heard the learned astronomer, when I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon unaccountable I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars.
So, I think we should take we'll take as much time as we like. As we had yesterday, a response to the provocation we heard, here's an opportunity to ask questions of our scholar performers in that last work.
Always creates, for me at least, uneasiness, frustration.
And I think it does. It has various functions, or it does various things. I mean, we have a radio program, or a monthly radio program, where we do this slightly different, but sometimes similar, sometimes with guests, sometimes without guests. And I think it sort of is developing from there. We might actually leave the radio studio and only do it live. Because there's something about doing it live, though I don't know what Daniela brings, and Daniela has no idea what I bring. I don't know what I'm going to do with this stuff. We do things, but things happen, and I think that is really what happens in art, and this is what happens in research. And I think it's also somewhere about, for me, as an artist who writes, not to have these hierarchies between scholarship and practice. some prepared elements. And I think that's what research is too. There are some prepared elements and then you do stuff with it. And I'm excited to be with someone, the tension of going between, say, the material and the page, but between what we do differently with the different material. I think that's what's exciting about how this is going to evolve.
And I think you said something. You use the word hierarchies, which is really important to me. It's also about this excitement of doing it at this very specific time and without thinking too much about what we're going to bring. It's about, well, okay, let's discuss silence and what's in our mind at the moment. It's not about the desert island lists, the absolute list of
my love.
Of reference and materials around the topics. It's not that. I think it's the opposite. If we did it next week, it would be completely different.
It's very contingent. And I think that it makes clear how research is very contingent, and it is as unscientific as art, or art is as scientific as any other research. There is coincidences, there is accidents, there is contingency, there is the moments. And I think we're performing those moments. In different ways. And it is also about this at conferences. I've been at conferences in other music departments where not a single sound was played. And it just amazes me every time. So we talk about sound, but we're not playing it. So I think this forces to really put the text and the sound, gain the equivalence of experience, and their experience to sound, or silence, and to deal with it.
And with their materiality, without saying what we're going to play, without putting footnotes, and just trying to experience them in the moment when they're read or played.
If we talk about this as a fine example of extemporality, which has both the extemp and the orality in it. Do you find each of you that even though you may have read these passages before aloud, that you read them differently aloud in the new context each time?
Completely. I mean, I sort of read them, you know, yesterday in the living room while my kids were off school playing in the next room. And that's obviously an extremely different scenario than speaking them into this room with this very big dominating organ behind you. Maybe it has a huge influence on how I experience my own voice. And also the content. I experience the content differently. And I also get that anxiety in the middle of reading it aloud. What it does now in the room. What does this writing do now in the room that I have given it a context? And sometimes I think, oh my God, I don't mean to agree with this, or I don't mean this. And if you were writing an article, you would qualify it. You'd say, well, I actually don't agree with this. But you've spoken it out now, and it's in the room now, in juxtaposition is all this other material, and it's going to be fine.
But it's also about what each sound or each tech does in sequence with what the other has read or played before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a single element, but it's this construction which sometimes doesn't quite work, sometimes it's quite good, and it's fine. It's, I think it mirrors very much.
And then
the
it's
way
funny what that means, it doesn't quite work. Because I was wondering what that means when it quite works and when it doesn't quite work, and whether, you know, coming from music, whether then I think, oh, musically works, it harmonically works, or cinematographically, soundtrack-wise works. What, you know, it would probably be okay if it wouldn't work at all.
But as readers, are you changing the dynamics, the tempo, the volume of what you're reading each time also?
I think so. It feels different. For example, reading the Richard Ford, The Woman Dead on the Bed, is a very different reading when you read the whole story alone at home silently to yourself and you know how you got to that dead woman, or when you just layer into the room with your voice, and your voice becomes self-conscious as you do so, but you can't get back now, you can't stop. Well, you could, but so tempos change, volume change, my feeling of what I say change, definitely.
But for example, with the Beckett text, the unnameable, you can do so much with it.
Mm-hmm.
You can be really slow. It could be. I always thought I wanted to do something with just reading it, the whole of it from the beginning to the end, while something else happens in the room. And I think it's fantastic, and I can't predict it. It's very much. I couldn't plan how it was going to be today. I didn't know that someone was going to start playing some noises. So when I wanted to become very silent, my voice started to become louder, and it wasn't expected, but that's how it was.
I think you're onto something very deep with the materiality of intellectual production here, of laying out the text, and it reminds me, I'm old enough, the very first papers I used to write with a co-author, this is before word processors, we used to have the text on the floor. So the cutting and pasting was actually done on the floor of this guy's office. And it's a very different form of intellectual production to using a word processor and digital form of production. There's something about the materiality of the text being there, which bits you use and the patterning. So I wonder if you could just reflect a little bit on the patterning of the objects here and the mixed media, the fact you have some digital files, some are in what I would call, you know, the analog, and they're beautiful with these little post-its, whatever they are. And it's an object of love that you've gone to bits and parts. And could you reflect a bit on this sort of mixture of all this stuff and the layout? Does the layout, for instance, matter?
Well, I don't know whether when I write, I work like this. I don't. Screens do make me a bit anxious, the limitation, and also these laptops are very small screens. So I do put stuff, the stuff I'm writing about is in the room with me at that moment, and I sadly haven't got an office, so obviously it has to be put back in a pile in the evening and then it gets spread out again in the morning, so the way it's spread out is every time very different. But I think maybe these are other analogies to an art practice. It's an art practice, it's the material, it's things can also then be dismissed, and I don't want that one, and I don't want that one. And,
for me, this is very much part of how I work. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this is like, I think ultimately I'm a reader before anything else, and this is like all of my books have got, I don't know, they're very, inhabited, and they're color-coded, and I won't tell you because it's a bit crazy. But this is part of what I do, and I work a lot with photocopies too, so I wanted them there. And I'm using film a lot recently, and I wanted it to be here somehow. I don't think we ever really discussed the layout. It's just how it is.
Is it more well, there's something about having a screen, you know, and it's a flat image in front of you, and it has no substance, that image. I mean, you know, there's a materiality to it, but it has no substance, and this is something you have to walk through, and the books are in a sense undergoing humiliation in being placed on the floor, and you're stepping through them in a gingerly fashion, trying not to tread on them. But that walking through seems to me maybe important, rather than this idea of, I mean, it would be much simpler just to have it all as digital files, and less to carry and less to worry about. But the idea that everything can be projected, almost as if we're back in church, you know, looking at.
Maybe this is a Catholic church, whereas that would be a Protestant church.
How is this a Catholic church?
It's got all the relics, it's got all the stuff, you've got to kiss that heel and that heel, and the you know, it sort of drags in the debris, the stuff. But no, I mean, I'm not
talking. You destroyed my thought.
But I like it's on the floor. I mean, we had a discussion this morning, David and I, about the floor and about his practice on the floor. And I think the floor, it's something very attractive about the floor, how it lays there and you can pick it up and you put it back there, and but it doesn't fall over the edge of the table, and it doesn't... and maybe again, it's part of not having an office. You know, the table I write on is also the table I eat on and my children draw on, and so everything has to be constantly moved, so it's much easier to use other spaces in the flat to work and be. And there's something really problematic. It can't fall down any further, you know, it's there. And yes, you can also be a bit, I can stand on it, my foot can stay there. It's okay, you know, it's not an overvaluing of these worthy, valuable books behind glass shelves. It's things, it's objects, and
It goes back to what we were saying at the beginning about the format, I think. I hope it's an invite. I would love to go to these reunions and conferences and see more people with their stuff, rather than just with a very neatly organized summary of 5 chapters of a book that has to be squashed into 15 minutes. And I'd much rather hear what's in people's mind at the moment in terms of what they're concerned with in relation to what they're doing.
Perhaps in cinematic terms, it's impressionistic rather than literal, isn't it? So you get it's more like a gesture to a field of linked references and associations, rather than the literalism of the sequence. So it's cinematic in a particular tradition.
Well, there's a performance involved.
Yeah.
We get up, we stand up, we sit down, we are there, our bodies are there also, we're not hiding behind a lectern, where our voices are sort of being disembodied through the scholarship, and we are not actually a body, we're just a voice telling you of all those clever things we've thought out. And here it's more we actually making you do the thinking between things, and the body becomes more prominent as that which goes and picks up things and is awkward and is there and goes red and hot and presses things and, you know, that sort of body.
I wonder about the dichotomy between literal and impressionistic.
It's one which comes from the documentary literature. It was current in the 30s as a way of thinking about different forms of documentary. There's the sort of the more expository form, and for which I can't remember the actual term they use, but impressionistic is the form they use for something which is more allusive, more emotional.
Is that
a big mouse? George is a big mouse. I wonder, because we should probably be thinking about moving towards lunch at this point, when the conversation will of course continue, whether you'd like to pick out anything, or anybody in the room would like to pick out anything specifically about our theme today of music and silence. Was there anything about any one of your particular excerpts, or anything that anybody particularly heard?
You created very good signs now with that question.
I was going to say that.
I'm thinking about the projector, the sound of the projector of the silent film, and just that sound for quite, you know, fairly extended period of time, and the sense in which there were images, which I guess that related back to the Herzog excerpt, or I don't know if that was deliberate choice or kind of fortuitous, but the sense of things which can't be shown, which have a sound, have an environmental sound around them.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, they definitely go together. It's something that I've been thinking about, these two films and other things. examples about what is shown and what is not shown, mm-hmm. and the fact that in Sunset Boulevard, there's that very classic scene where they watch silent movies. But I didn't want to show them watching a silent movie. I wanted to exaggerate this idea of for the protagonist, Norma Desmond, silence was full mm-hmm. of presence. It was her life. So I just wanted to bring that.
I thought it was very powerful when you had the sound playing over your voice and you were still talking and you could still hear what you were saying, but slowly just certain words came through.
Mm.
That seemed very powerful.
When I was reading the book, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
This is something that we're starting to try.
I suppose becoming more daring with each other,
mm.
how far we were allowed to cancel each other out. And I suppose that's the kind of improvisory relationship we're developing.
It was sort of interesting metaphor of silencing by sound, other sound. So.
And it is a sound, incidentally, by Aisuke Yamasawa, which we can't hear because it's the electromagnetic sounds of a Dell computer, which you wouldn't hear if it wasn't recorded with a very specific microphone. So it's quite interesting to drown you out.
But you don't
with
know
silence,
when
yeah.
the computer, which
but you don't know when she is going to mask you.
No.
You, okay.
We never make plans.
Because I thought that you were watching her and then she turned on the volume.
No.
Okay.
You didn't decide on the Beckett in advance, so that was a moment. Because that's
know,
kind of a brilliant choice.
Sometimes it works really well, sometimes it's a catastrophe. And it's great that sometimes it works. It means that we can go on.
Yeah.
No, it's not planned.
No.
I think it's about listening to each other.
Yes,
because we've been talking to each other for 2 years now. Every month we meet and we record these conversations for radio. I think we're familiar with each other, so it's not, she's not a stranger. I'm not a stranger.
So I suppose that is music. I mean, if you want music in the discussion, I think that's like making music. You know, that's the music bit where you do sounds, stuff with sound together.
Mm-hmm.
It's two or in a group. It's like a duet, an improvised duet with stuff that makes sound.
Good. That's a natural silence. So thank you very much once again. The conversation will continue. And lunch is served for us.
Appearance were Salome Vögling, not quite sitting down for 6 minutes, Danny Carms, the plummeting old woman, Richard Ford, women with men, Billy Wilder, Sunset Boulevard, Actors from Stannis, Night in a Sail Ship, Brandon Lebel, the Lexicon of the Mind, Beth Jorke, the Distant Sound, Lawrence Abraham Down, The Right to Remain Silent, Pauline Oliveros, Ghosting, Francis Dyson, The Toll Bell Time, Cherry Hunt, Hans Ford, Monocle, Ariana Reigns, Fleur de Lyon, Samuel Beckett, The Unnameable, Aisuke Yanagisawa, Dan, Steve Goodman, Sonic Warfare, Werner Herzog, Grizzly Man, Film Trailer, Ingmar Bergman, The Silence, Arthur Rambo, Mystical, Walt Whitman, When I Heard the Lone Was Drowning, Cosmos, and The Flood. I'm not going to do that.